Welcome back to the Berlin Security Beat, brought to you by the Center for International Security at the Hertie School in Berlin. I'm your host, David Bukowski. I'm excited to bring you the fifth episode of our second season focused on bridging the gap between theory and practice and understanding how security professionals have built their careers. Today's guest is Dr. Gorana Gergic, Senior Lecturer at the Department of Government and International Relations and the United States Studies Center at the University of Sydney, and recently, a Research Fellow at the Center for International Security. Gorana is an expert on, among others, U.S. foreign policy, transatlantic relations, and she has worked with a wide range of institutions, including the EU, NATO, and the Australian Ministry of Defense. Having consulted governments and corporations across her career as an academic, she is perfectly positioned to talk about bridging theory and practice. Gorana, welcome.
Thank you very much for having me.
Okay, thank you so much for joining us. Could you start by briefly outlining your professional journey for our listeners?
Well, that's a great kind of big question. My journey so far, I think that I'm still very much a work in progress, given that I'm not that super old, or I would like to think that I'm not that old. And that, you know, I still think that sometimes I kind of wake up thinking, what am I going to be in, you know, 10 or 20 years from now? So it's definitely kind of a story that's developing. But my journey thus far starts with me actually being a lapsed macroeconomist. So I have a bachelor in economics, and that was the kind of original plan to maybe move somewhere more like international economics. But when I graduated with my bachelor's, world kind of collapsed because it was the year of the global financial crisis. And so the opportunities for getting scholarships in things that I wanted and where I wanted just disappeared overnight, literally. So my graduation was in October of 2008, and we know how that September looked on the Wall Street. So anyway, I always wanted to be a bit more interdisciplinary. And so during my bachelor's, I actually spent nearly a year in Singapore, the National University of Singapore, as an exchange student. And there I took a lot of classes specifically in international relations. And basically, this inspired me to think about my postgrad studies as something that would take me more into the storytelling rather than economic and econometric modeling. And one of the rare places that wasn't hit by the global financial crisis and at that point didn't experience recession for nearly two decades was Australia. And I ended up in Sydney specifically because there were scholarships that the University of Sydney was offering, because at that point, as an international student coming from Croatia, you can imagine tuition fees would have been exorbitant to just kind of work out of your pocket. And so I did my master's in Sydney thinking, okay, this is great, you know, now I'm going to go back and be what I was intending to be, which is, you know, someone who works at a central bank and thinks about international economics. But then I also applied for a PhD scholarship in Australia, never thinking that I would get it. It was part of an Australian Research Council grant project, which was led by one of my professors for my master's degree. And I did end up getting it. After, you know, kind of rounds of these interviews and sending proposals and whatnot, really didn't think that I would have gotten it. And so that's how my story of kind of being in Australia really started in earnest, completed my PhD there. And then I often joke, I sort of started staying on as a part of furniture. Basically, Sydney University couldn't get rid of me.
As someone who has worked in multiple roles across academia and policy, how do you bridge the gap between theory and practice as you enter the field? You are still in academia, and so you're linked to theory, but you're also a practitioner.
Yeah, that's a great question. And I think I can't answer this question without first giving a shout out to people who are part of the Bridging the Gap project, because there is such a thing, connecting academia and practice over at the American University. So Jim Goldgeier and Bruce Gentleson, who is from Duke University, but they're basically the kind of academic fathers along with a great team of scholars with them. there who actually have started very serious conversation about how we as international relations scholars can actually improve policymaking out there and how we can get the academic work, which has often been deemed as part of this kind of cult of the irrelevant or, you know, part of the impenetrable sort of ivory towers, to make an impact on ground. And, you know, it kind of might sound easier said than done, but I think that there are really important conversations that are being had and initiatives that we have seen really spill over, not just in terms of the way that policymakers interact with academics these days, but more broadly, how do we bring the community on board? And I think that we've really seen that, especially in the way, you know, you look at the media and some of the papers of record, not just in the United States, but also, you know, in Australia, in Europe, that now see the real value of this translational work. For instance, the work that The Conversation does, right, or Monkey Cage blog within Washington Post, or different explainers that New York Times provides. So there is really a lot more thought that goes into how do we actually incorporate the knowledge of experts, and how does this actually better inform the debates that we have as a broader public, but also how does it change policy, which hopefully, you know, if you're an academic in a field like ours, you would hope that you would get that traction. So in my work in specific, I do a lot of different things depending on kind of where I sit in a given day or kind of on a project that I'm involved in, because I'm jointly appointed by a classical sort of academic department, so government and international relations, but also half of my time is with the U.S. Study Center, which is more public policy kind of think tank, policy institute oriented, and where I get to interact much more frequently with policymakers and to try to sort of explain Australia to Americans and America to Australians, and then propose some solutions for this alliance. And this is, again, you know, you can think about it that way. So working on things like different white papers, strategic reviews. There was a huge kind of interest in Australian position and views, for instance, when different European countries were developing their Indo-Pacific strategies. We had a number of visits from the likes of, you know, German Federal Foreign Office or French Ministry of Foreign Affairs or the European Union's High Representative for Security Policy and Foreign Affairs. So there are these kinds of opportunities. But also, you know, again, in terms of media work that I would do that are basically informed by my own research, this is another avenue you could bridge the gap. And then working with different types of industries, whether it's the kind of intergovernmental organizations or corporate organizations, which more and more are taking notice of how basically the geopolitical changes are having impact on their businesses, on the way that they strategize, and how this might have an impact on their bottom line, which we've seen obviously from Australia's perspective, the kind of huge change in its relations with China, and obviously what the intensifying competition in the Indo-Pacific means for, you know, someone who might be, you know, leading a department within a major bank in Australia or within a major infrastructure company and similar.
That's really interesting. Thank you. Can you share an instance in which your work has had a direct impact on policymaking? Do you have any examples where you've made an impact and how that looks like in practice?
Yeah, I think it's always a bit sort of presumptuous to say, you know, as an individual, I made an impact, you know, I've really changed the kind of game on something. I would err on the on the side of humility and caution here and say, you know, even if I kind of manage to get one kind of idea distinctly into someone's mind, you know, who might be in a position of kind of having that kind of power to change things, I'd be happy to kind of take credit for that. But I guess maybe two kind of brief stories. One speaks to the time when I was fellow with the NATO Defense College as part of the contingent called Partners Across the Globe. So that was 2 years ago, 2021. And that's obviously the year that led to the new strategic concept, when there were a lot of kind of ideas being thrown around. What is NATO to do with this sudden appearance of China in some of its major strategic communication, and obviously realization that NATO needs to do something about it? And I, as someone who, again, who came from Australia, I'm a dual citizen, by the way, so, and I'm a resident of Australia, so it's kind of weird that someone with a distinctly non-Australian name was working on something that is very much specific to that region. And the kind of story goes to this issue of NATO's partnerships in the Indo-Pacific. And basically, up until not that long ago, NATO tended to think about these various partners across the globe as a kind of just huge basket of countries that were picked up along the way, but that didn't really kind of make sense as grouping in any way. They weren't a kind of functional group, but you had the likes of Australia, New Zealand, Japan and Korea, together with Afghanistan prior to the fall, prior to the takeover of the Taliban, Iraq, Pakistan, Mongolia. You know, you basically had this kind of hodgepodge, Colombia as well. So of countries that, you know, were both security providers and consumers, some that were actually targets of NATO's non-Article 5 missions, others that were contributing to those missions, etc. And so my idea was that we actually need to find a different way to talk about how we engage in cooperating with partners across the globe, and to provide a little bit of a framework for NATO as well to think about how to look at these different partners, specifically thinking about how capable they are, how compatible they are to NATO, and actually whether they're willing to do it at all. Because we know that also in the kind of vast group of contact countries that NATO has, and Singapore, for instance, being an example of that, there are countries that explicitly don't want to be called partners as well, right? And how do we sort of talk about that? Because that signals something, and it's very, you know, kind of delicate vis-a-vis China. Anyway, so to cut the very long story short, published some pieces, had some conversations with people in the HQ. And what I hope that this research did, and I was told that it did, was planted some seeds, at least in terms of thinking about the engagement with some of these countries. And then the end result is that these days we hear much more about the Asia Pacific Four, so Australia, New Zealand, Japan, South Korea, rather than the kind of disparate set of these partners across the globe. I'm not saying that I'm in any way responsible for that, that the grouping has been there before, but for sure to kind of distinguish between different types of partners was something that was very important. And so you can do that by, you know, by talking to people, by doing the research, by basically publishing on that front.
It's great to hear about the channels through which research can affect policymaking, and also to hear about the kind of interesting research that even the military can engage in. I'd like to move on and talk about young professionals and skill sets. It's something we cover a lot on this podcast. What skills do you think are the most important for young professionals who want to work in this field?
This is a great question, and I think that you'll probably get a lot of different sort of perspectives and answers depending on where people are in their careers and also in terms of the industries they are in. But for me, at least, I would say if you are someone who is, you know, in their early 20s, or, you know, you might just switch into this kind of field, so you're just young in this field, I would say that there is really no substitute for knowledge, for educating yourself, for, you know, reading as widely and broadly in terms of your field to actually get a sense of what it is and to have that intellectual ballast. Because that's something that no ChatGPT or anyone else can actually do for you, right? Because we now know, of course, you know, AI is possible to kind of generate essays and all that, or give you some answers. But if you actually don't know what happened, or kind of you don't know the basic kind of contours of what particular debates are going on in your field, or what's the kind of state of the art research and knowledge, it will be very hard for you to then make any use of these kind of tools, like, you know, kind of generative pre-trained transformers and whatnot. So I would say, you know, just make sure that as you go through your master's degrees or your PhDs, that you really don't miss out on that opportunity to have that kind of grounding in the literature. And then along with that come the different types of analytical skills together with writing, reading. For me, as someone who is, you know, from a background that's non-English speaking, this was really something that I had to do in parallel. So it probably comes to native speakers more easily, but I would also say sometimes it might lead to complacency. So don't just think that, you know, because some particular language is your mother tongue, that you're necessarily going to just ace it. I think also good writing, which is essential in our field, you know, you asked about policy relevance. If you're not able to communicate well, right, sort of knowledge that you might have might not be actually put to a good use. And then in terms of, you know, again, I don't know how practical this is in terms of this is a skill. I think showing up, being there, right? This is something that has no substitute. Again, similar to that building of the intellectual ballast of those reading and writing skills and all that. Being there, not just when, you know, famous kind of senior scholars are around and kind of, you know, schmoozing with the faculty, but being there for your peers, for your colleagues, setting up networks as you are on this journey is critical, because your colleagues are actually those future superstars. You might be one of them as well, right? And I think it's really important to just be present, to, again, be part of these communities. And in that respect, it's great that we are able to now, again, come together, to be in classrooms, to go to conferences, symposia, right? Events, make use of that. Even if, you know, sometimes topics that might be out there, you know, advertised as part of different research colloquia aren't necessarily within your field or are not quite what you were thinking about. I can't tell you how much I benefited from just attending things that weren't necessarily within my area of specialization. So, you know, political science is so broad, and sometimes having that step back and thinking about, well, what would a political philosopher say, or what would someone from sociology say? And then, you know, kind of thinking about your research in that sort of context, to me, I found it immensely helpful. And one final thing, if this is a skill, or I just would say kind of an ingredient that to me was crucial on the journey, is to find a good mentor, to find someone who is going to be your cheerleader. This might be, you know, someone who was your supervisor during your thesis. This might be just like a professor, someone from the faculty, or maybe an employer, but definitely someone who has a bit more experience, let's put it that way, who can just offer some perspective as you're kind of navigating these early stages of your career. someone who will be willing to write those references and you know, write them and kind of add to them and do that end times and whatnot until you get to that job that you want. That's really important. So while, you know, you might have kind of big networks, having a person or a couple of people who are there throughout your journey. And I certainly can say that I've benefited from that. I still keep in touch with my PhD supervisor, and I really am immensely grateful for not just his input. So that's Professor Ben Goldsmith from Australian National University, but many others who kind of, you know, have acted on my behalf and who have been advocates for me, and who have actually taught me that in academia, we need to learn to pay it forward. So basically, then the kind of thing that I need to do is to be a mentor, to be that reference writer, to be that check-in point for my students, for maybe junior colleagues and so on. So if those were kind of the three things that could make a difference, at least from my perspective, hopefully they could, I hope they could be useful for some of your listeners.
I'd like to now talk a little bit about your public and media work, because you're a regular political analyst for ABC News Australia, among others. So you've undoubtedly honed your media and presentation skills. So I wonder if you have some advice for aspiring analysts on how to effectively communicate their ideas.
So you're absolutely right. I had a bit of a kind of ground advantage by having had that experience working once upon a time as a producer and a journalist for SBS Australia, and actually working in their radio department and also a bit with the newsroom. So it did help to have also a bit of that media training. So this is something that I did part-time as I was a full-time PhD student who desperately needed to earn some pocket money. And I think that I would be probably the worst person to do any sort of retail or anything like that. So this was a kind of side job along with tutoring and teaching at the university. But anyway, I really have to say that that was an invaluable lesson in terms of how actually the world of journalism, of media works, and, you know, somewhere where actually time is this, time becomes that kind of the greatest resource. You know, international relations, power is the kind of currency of the realm, then for sure, for journalism, being kind of timely, thinking about time in radio, every second being accounted for, you know, constantly looking at that clock, is something that you really have to keep in mind. So that was really great, but also taught me a lot about how stories are made and how media presents certain things. And it always revolves around the big five W's and whatnot. You know, we kind of know a bit about that, the kind of who, what, when, why, and all that. But I also learned to be way more economical in the way that I express myself. And probably I should employ that, or should have employed that more as we are having this conversation. But in general, if we were in a kind of TV or radio setting or doing something that was more kind of short and sharp media, to kind of know how to package that message. So maybe that would be the first advice. If you are interacting with media, make sure that you actually know the audience who you're speaking to, right? There is a huge difference between speaking to, you know, breakfast television, where probably they want to keep it light and so on, as opposed to doing a segment around 7, 8 p.m. kind of prime time on a political show, where you get to do a bit more kind of jargon heavy or kind of be more elaborate in your answers. So you will determine that obviously in your sort of interactions with the journalists. And then ahead of the interview, ahead of the engagement, make sure that you actually do the homework around what is it that they are asking you to comment on. Never agree to something, you know, just 5 minutes before and kind of go there. Make sure that you actually have those talking points, because nothing can substitute that preparation. So I think that that's really important because oftentimes, especially, you know, if you find yourself in situations where you might be debating someone, it's very easy to kind of get carried away. And that might leave you also a bit vulnerable or might expose that, you know, you might not know absolutely everything. And, you know, sometimes the one thing that in some of the media trainings you get thought is never say that there are five things unless you know exactly what those five things are. So that's exactly why you need to come prepared. I think that there are plenty of those great videos. I think Rick Perry at the presidential debates in 2012 was a great example. Anyway, if you guys have no idea who I'm talking about, just go and look it up. But I would say preparation is something that's crucial there, along with knowing your audience. And once you are there, once you are actually engaging with the media, I always come back to this advice, which is take the job seriously, but don't take yourself seriously. What I mean by this, you know, you obviously, if you have come prepared, if you know your stuff, right? If you have those talking points, you already have it. It doesn't matter. So sometimes, you know, you might have a little bit of a blank in your head. You might have a bit of stage fright, especially if this is early on in your media engagements. There is no harm in that. Actually, you would be surprised how little people will pay attention to those things. I mean, you know, like sometimes also disasters can happen. And again, you know, I think BBC Dad and things like that are examples. But, you know, even when you have toddlers who are crawling into the room, you know, you can stay on top if you are an expert, right? And, you know, you kind of, you can sort of laugh about that and keep on going. So I would say absolutely, you know, take the job with utmost seriousness, but don't think that it's the end of the world if you stumbled or if you kind of mis-expressed yourself or you said the wrong word or something like that. Again, dwelling on those kind of little things and sweating the small stuff in the grander scheme of things, if you do overall make sense and if you're a professional, I don't think that they matter as much. So the kind of inner voice in us always tends to point out to those things, but why did you say that? You mumbled, you know, ultimately that's not what people see. And breathe and slow down, I think, is always a good advice that I often have to tell myself, because as well, when you are working kind of in front of the cameras, you want to kind of just like, here it is, say everything. But of course, sometimes slowing down helps to convey message much better than rushing through.
That's great advice. Thank you. Our final question is always the same for all our guests. If you could give one piece of advice to your younger self, to your 20-year-old self, what would it be?
Well, this is the advice that I always give myself. I keep on telling myself, which is there are no wrong paths. There are no mistakes, especially, you know, to my younger self, you know, someone in their teens or 20s. Every path is an educational opportunity or experience in retrospect. I think overall, again, I think we opened this conversation by saying we are a bit of a work in progress. So that work never stops. Saying that there is one particular path, and I really enjoyed listening to your podcast with Constance Stelzenmüller because she pointed that out as well, that, you know, there are often career gaps and different sort of trajectories and people switching careers and all that. I think this is absolutely true. And you know, for someone who is, you know, kind of a major voice in the field, like Dr. Stelzenmüller, I would absolutely say that, you know, that's something that reassures me as someone who is a bit more junior, but probably kind of now sitting in the middle of kind of where she is and someone who is starting off in the field. And again, I say this to students often who ask me for career advice. You know, even if that kind of dream job or dream internship doesn't pan out, it's okay. Something else will. And just make sure that whatever it is that you end up doing in its place as well, that you learn from it. And if it's not something that you want to do, great, because actually it told you what not to do maybe down the line. Or maybe it just opens up kind of world that you never expected to experience. So for me, you know, the fact that I ended up staying in Australia and now I'm kind of this, I often joke, a lone transatlanticist in the middle of the Indo-Pacific, but such is world where actually there is a lot more interest in the way that transatlantic relations impact the Indo-Pacific and vice versa, right? To me, is one of these kind of things that I could have never planned some 10 or 15 years ago when I was either starting my master's or my PhD. So as probably just about everyone on the podcast has said, it's okay, you know, take a deep breath and it's all going to work out fine. I think we look back at our lives and then it all makes sense in retrospect somehow, right? But when you're in the middle of it and when you really think, oh, I'm lost, I think that there are always opportunities out there. For some, of course, you're going to have to work harder. And again, they might not just come out of nowhere. But if you do have, coming back to some of the points that we mentioned, if you do have that intellectual ballast, if you have the knowledge, if you have built those networks, if you have good mentors, I think something ought to come, right? Because those are usually the things that expose you to the world of opportunities that are out there. So don't be scared. And hopefully in some 20 years, when I listen to this, I'll kind of make sense as well of how it is that I've ended up where I'm going to be in 2043 or something along those lines. But it's all going to be okay. There are really no mistakes, no wrong paths.
Karana, thank you so much for being on our podcast.
Thank you so much for having me, and I look forward to listening more of the Security Beat.
That's all for today, folks. Thank you so much for joining us on the Berlin Security Beat. If you're interested in international security, you would like to know more, please follow us on all our channels on Twitter, Instagram, and LinkedIn. If you would like to study international security, the Hurdy School offers an excellent master's in international affairs with an international security specialization. And please join us next month where we'll be talking about what it's like to work at NATO. Until then, from Berlin, David Bukowski, signing off.